Have you ever tried to hold a heading with one eye swollen shut and blood filling your cockpit? I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair because the story I've got today is one of those that makes you sit back and just shake your head at what a human being can do when the only other option is dying in the ocean. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, August 7th, 1942. The Americans have just landed on Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands. It's the first major Allied offensive in the Pacific, and the Japanese are scrambling to respond. Among the pilots launched from Rabaul that morning is a 26-year-old petty officer named Saburo Sakai, already one of the Imperial Japanese Navy's top aces by that point in the war. He had somewhere around 60 confirmed victories. The man was an artist in the cockpit of a Mitsubishi A6M0, and I don't use that word lightly. Now, you have to understand what kind of pilot Sakai was. He grew up dirt poor in Saga Prefecture on the southern island of Kyushu, failed out of school, joined the Navy at 16 because he had nowhere else to go. He was stubborn, proud, and absolutely determined to prove himself. And in flight training, something clicked. The instructors saw it right away. His eyesight was extraordinary. He could reportedly spot enemy aircraft at distances that left other pilots squinting at empty sky. His situational awareness bordered on supernatural, and his hands on the controls were so smooth that his zero seemed to respond to thought more than input. By the time Guadalcanal happened, Sakai had been fighting for years. He'd flown over China. He'd been in the air over the Philippines, over the Dutch East Indies. He'd tangled with P-40s, Brewster Buffaloes, Hurricanes, you name it. He knew what a dogfight felt like the way you and I know what a crosswind landing feels like. It was in his bones. So on that August morning, Sakai's flight of Zeros is escorting bombers toward Guadalcanal. They're at about 20,000 feet. The trip from Rabaul is long, something like 560 miles one way. That's a punishing mission in a single-engine fighter, even one with the Zero's legendary range. You're sitting on a fuel tank with no armor behind you and no self-sealing fuel cells. The Zero was fast, and it could turn inside anything the Americans had, but it was built like a paper lantern. One good burst, and it came apart. Sakai spots a formation of what he thinks are Grumman F-4F Wildcats below him. He rolls in for a bounce, classic fighter pilot move, coming down out of the sun with speed and altitude on his side. But as he closes the distance, something is wrong. The silhouettes don't look right. These aren't Wildcats. They're Grumman TBF Avengers, torpedo bombers, and they're bigger, tougher, and they've got rear gunners who are very much awake. Now here's where it gets interesting. Sakai realized his mistake too late. He was already committed, already in the merge. He pressed the attack because that's what fighter pilots did in 1942. Especially Japanese fighter pilots who'd been trained to never break off. He raked one Avenger with his twin 7.7mm guns and his 20mm cannons, but the rear gunners on those Avengers opened up on him, and at least one of them connected. A 30 caliber round, maybe more than one, hit Sakai in the head. The bullet or bullet fragments tore into the left side of his skull above the eye. It destroyed the vision in his left eye. Fragments peppered his body, blood poured down his face, and filled the cockpit. The impact was so violent that he was temporarily paralyzed on his left side. His Zero rolled and dove, and for a moment, Saburo Sakai was a dead man in a falling airplane. But he wasn't dead, and this is where the story becomes something I can barely comprehend. Even after 50 years of flying, he came to. He was blind in one eye, half paralyzed, bleeding profusely, and his Zero was screaming toward the ocean in an uncontrolled dive. Through sheer will, he grabbed the stick, pulled the nose up, and leveled off. Now think about this. He's 560 miles from Rabaul, over open ocean. No navigation aids, no radio contact that's going to help him. His instrument panel is smeared with blood. He can barely see out of his one good eye. The pain in his head is so intense that he keeps blacking out. And every time he loses consciousness, the Zero starts to nose over again. He is completely and utterly alone. A lot of pilots would have put it in the water right there. Nobody would have blamed him, but Sakai made a decision. He was going to fly home, and for the next 4.5 hours, that's exactly what he did. He navigated by the sun. When the pain became unbearable, he would bite down on his scarf or dig his fingernails into his wounds to shock himself awake. Every time he started to pass out, the nose would drop, the engine note would change, and that change in sound would pull him back just enough to level the wings. Think about that. The sound of his own engine was the only thing keeping him alive. The Nakajima Sakai radial was singing him home, and every shift in pitch was a slap across the face that said, "Wake up, you're dying, fly the airplane." He couldn't see his instruments clearly. Blood kept seeping into his good eye. He'd wipe it away, get a few seconds of blurry vision, and try to hold a heading. The sun moved across the sky and he corrected for it the way ancient mariners did, by instinct and experience and sheer cussedness. 4.5 hours. Over open Pacific, with a bullet in his head. When Sakai finally spotted the coastline of New Britain and the harbor at Rabaul, he still had to land, and landing a zero with one eye and half your body not responding properly is not something they teach in any flight school. He came in fast. He knew he was going to get one shot at this. The depth perception was gone with his left eye. He misjudged the flare, hit hard, bounced, but kept it on the strip. The ground crew pulled him out of the cockpit and couldn't believe he was alive. His flight suit was soaked through with blood. The cockpit looked like someone had been butchered in it. The doctors who treated him at Rabaul said the wounds should have been fatal. The skull fracture alone should have killed him. The blood loss should have killed him. The 4.5 hours of hypoxia at altitude with a head wound should have killed him. But Sakai was not interested in what should have happened. He was evacuated to Japan. He spent months in the hospital. He lost the eye permanently. Surgeons did what they could with the skull damage, but he'd carry the scars and the headaches for the rest of his life. And here's the part that gets me every time. He went back. Saburo Sakai returned to combat flying, with one eye. In 1944, he was back in a zero, flying missions over Iwo Jima. He was the only Japanese ace to survive the entire war who had seen frontline combat from start to finish. From China in 1938 to the last days over Japan in 1945, he was never shot down. Think about that for a second. In an airplane with no armor, fighting against increasingly superior American aircraft with one eye, he was never shot down, not once. After the war, Sakai struggled the way a lot of combat veterans do. Japan was in ruins. The military culture he'd been raised in was dismantled. He had nothing. He tried different jobs. For a while, he ran a small print shop in Tokyo, but eventually he started talking about his experiences, and the world started listening. He wrote a memoir, published in Japan in 1953, and later translated into English under the title Samurai. If you haven't read it, put it on your list. It's one of the great combat aviation memoirs, right up there with anything written by the American or British aces. What makes it remarkable is Sakai's honesty. He doesn't glorify war. He talks about the friends he lost, the fear he felt, the waste of it all. He describes the killing with a matter-of-fact clarity that is more disturbing than any Hollywood version could ever be. And Sakai did something else that took a different kind of courage. He reached out to his former enemies. He became close friends with several American veterans, including Harold Jones, one of the Avenger gunners who may have been the man who shot him over Guadalcanal. Imagine that, sitting across a table from the man who put a bullet in your skull, shaking his hand, and calling him a friend. That's a kind of bravery that doesn't fit on a medal. Sakai visited the United States several times. He attended air shows and reunions. American pilots who had fought against the Zero treated him with enormous respect because they knew what it took to survive what he survived. He wasn't just a great pilot. He was the pilot who proved that the machine only matters if the person inside it refuses to quit. He died in 2000 at the age of 84 at a dinner honoring American naval aviators at the Atsugi Air Base in Japan. He had a heart attack at the table. He'd spent his last evening in the company of pilots talking about flying. There's something fitting about that. You know, I've told a lot of stories on this show about pilots who did extraordinary things, but Sakai's 4-hour flight home from Guadalcanal is one that I come back to again and again because it strips flying down to the most basic question there is. When everything has gone wrong, when the airplane is trying to kill you, when your own body is failing, do you fly the airplane? Sakai flew the airplane with one eye, half conscious, over 500 miles of empty ocean. He flew the airplane all the way home. Much of today's story comes from Sakai's own memoir, Samurai, co-written with Martin Kaden and from Henry Sakaita's research on Japanese aces of World War II. You can find more at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Go fly something.